We're going to turn in God's Word to Psalm 139 again, and do please open your Bible at page 441 if using a church Bible, and we'll look at Psalm 139. And as you do that, I want you to think for a moment, imagine for a moment that in my hand was a book. And in that book was absolutely everything that there is to know about you as an individual. Everything. Absolutely everything. Where you were born, when you were born, how that went, what your background was, where you live, what your family history is, the details about your time at school. In fact, in that book is every one of your school reports. Every single one. MI5 had managed to find them. And everything else. This is more than a sort of this is your life book. No, it's much worse than that. This is a this is you book. In fact, it's one of the modern books because it comes with a DVD illustrated. And in that DVD is not just everything about you and pictures from your history. No. In that DVD is the thoughts that go through your head displayed in full Technicolor for anyone that happens to have a DVD player. They can stick it in. It has all your motives, all of your ideas, all of your mental images. This book in my hand contains everything about you. How would you feel right now if I were to open that book and to read it out? Well, I'll tell you what, if it was the book about me, I'd want it burned. And I'd want the DVD destroyed. And I guess you might think the same. Worse still, how about if I didn't just read out selected portions of it? How about if I left it on the table next to the partition back there? And simply let anyone browse through it who wanted to. Or better still, how about that we take the DVD and plug it into that laptop and play it on the PowerPoint behind me so everyone can see? How would you feel? How would I feel? Well, Psalm 139 that is in front of us tonight tells us that the Lord doesn't need a book. Actually, he doesn't even need a DVD. It simply tells us, verses 1 to 6, that the Lord knows absolutely everything about us. Just look at verse 1 with me, will you? O Lord, says David, you have searched me. You have been through me. You have looked all over me. And you know me. You know every bit of me. Says David, who wrote the psalm, the Lord has searched him. He has been through all his motives, all his thoughts. He has cross-examined everything without even David knowing it. And the Lord knows everything. In my previous job, some years ago now, I spent a lot of time at airports. And from time to time, I had to pass through airport security. And in fact, I used to advise people on radiation safety and in airport security. It's very interesting if you ever go into what they used to call, I think they called it Star Wars in Terminal 3 at Heathrow. You go into Star Wars, it's not Star Wars at all, it's just a bank of computers, but they like the funny name. If you go into Star Wars in Terminal 3 as it used to be, there's all these screens up and all the baggage machines and everything. People used to believe that as they passed through the metal detectors, that the screens would show everything in them. Well, that certainly wasn't true then. I think John can tell us something about some adjustment to the technology, am I right? Where you can at least see what's going on under the clothes. Things have moved on since I did it. But just imagine for a moment that as a passenger walks through one of those metal detector tunnels, I always used to have this experience, if there was anything in my pocket, keys or anything like that, it would buzz and they'd want to search me and just go through all that rigmarole all over again. And many of them knew me and it was just a lot of aggravation. And they were checking for guns, I suppose. Maybe I look like that sort of a guy, I don't know. But the kind of searching that's going on here is not that kind of searching. The psalmist is talking about something much more thorough. It's not just a one-off. When the Lord searches us, it means that he is in us. He's with us. He's with us all the time. He knows us. This isn't a security sweep. It's not an Ofsted inspection. He's not checking us from time to time. He searches constantly. The eyes of the Lord search to and fro across the world. He's searching every part of our being all the time. Lord, you're looking at me constantly. Verse 2, it says that. You know, he says, when I sit and when I rise. You even perceive my thoughts from afar. You know what I'm going to think before I've thought it. You discern, he says, verse 3, my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. I can't really get my head around Twitter. Am I the only one? I can't get my head around Twitter because I can't understand why anyone would care I'm having a coffee. The coffee is hot. The coffee is finished. I'm having some sugar. I'm getting up. I'm getting on the bus. I'm getting on the... I can't understand who would care, actually. But you know what? God cares. And he doesn't need Twitter. Or Facebook. Or tweets. Or peeks or pokes or anything else that they call them now. Just think about that for a moment. God knows our movements. Literally, he surrounds us. You and I are totally encircled by him. That he holds us firm all the time. He is familiar with all your ways, not just our habits. He knows everything about us. Everything about us. Now, that's a really sobering thought. And it's a sobering thought because it's actually a reason, a motivation to keep right, isn't it? Before a word is on my tongue, he says, verse 4, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in, behind and before. You've laid your hand upon me. Literally, he's in front of me and he's behind me. And he has his arms around me. That's a great comfort, but it's also a great disincentive to sin. In the olden days, they used to put young people off going to the cinema with the question, would you be able to take Jesus with you into that scenario? Some of you will remember being asked that question. Actually, although the cinema question is another one I'm not going to enter into tonight, the general principle is a good question because he is with us all the time. It's a disincentive to sin, but it's also a cause for courage and not for fear. Reading some of the commentators on this psalm, you'd think that some of them were motivated when they read this, that David has been motivated by some kind of fear of God. There's a threat implied in God being around me all the time. But that's not what's going on here. If the Lord knows, and he is God, and nothing is beyond him, well, whatever he knows, you and I might not understand, but he does. Anything that you and I are going to face, he already knows. So rightly does David say, not, oh no, you know everything, God, what am I going to do about that? He says, verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. Too lofty for me to attain. It's beyond me. The fact that you know absolutely everything, Lord, I can hardly grasp that. But not just do you know everything, verse 1 to 6, but verses 7 to 12, you are, Lord, you are everywhere. In these days of the world village, as they call it, it's perfectly normal, apparently, for some folk, to just regard the world as just a really very small place. Simon doesn't mind me picking on him for a minute. How many passports have you used up in the last couple of years? Several, anyway. Because it's just, you know, I mean, you pop to Italy for the afternoon, don't you? And just kind of how it is. Flying thousands of miles is just like popping on a bus somewhere for some people. That's a far cry from what the psalmist envisaged when he asked the question in verse 7. Where can I go from your presence, from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? But then how could he have expressed the idea that God is everywhere, since he couldn't imagine everywhere? 100 years ago, it would have been reasonable to refer to the other side of the world and know that there were probably a dozen people in the United Kingdom that had ever had the experience of being there. But I know that for some people here, the other side of the world is somewhere that they've been for a few days of business. And whilst it's true that the Lord is there, we need a hyperbole to make the point. We need to take it to the extreme. So actually, David takes it to the extreme. Look at verse 8. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? What's the highest place I can think of? Here's one, verse 8. If I go up to the heavens, what am I going to find? I'm going to find that you're already there. If I could get on a rocket ship and I could somehow fly to the furthest possible reach of the universe, way beyond where the Hubble Space Telescope has ever been able to see, do you know what I would find? Where there was nothing else, nothing else. Do you know what I would find? I'd find that God was already there. Or if I could make my bed in the depths. In other words, if I could go down to the grave. Sheol is the Hebrew word here. You'll find it in a subnote there in the NIV. If I could somehow get to where the dead are, as it were. You know what I would find? I'd find that you're already there. Wherever I go, God is already there. Okay, let's try and catch you by surprise then, verse 9. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, do you know what I'm going to find? I'm going to find even there your hand will guide me and your right hand will hold me fast. We read this psalm as a family on different occasions. In the morning before, just after breakfast, and tend to read it on exam days, actually. But we also read it on travelling days as well. And I sometimes, just partly to tease my children and partly because it helps us all think about it, I will build into my reading of the psalm, wherever it is they're going or I'm going, put in where you're going tomorrow. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of, what would it be for you? London? Swindon? Bath? Bristol? Italy? Japan? Where? Trowbridge? If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of wherever it is I'm going to be, even there your hand will guide me, and your right hand will hold me fast. See, there is no way you or I or David could go that we would not find God is already there. Now, you might find that scary, but I hope you find it comforting. Actually, I guess it rather depends on how you view God, doesn't it? Whether you think God is out to get you or whether he is your loving Heavenly Father who is there with you. It depends. The famous Hound of Heaven poem by Francis Thomas sums up one way of viewing God that you can run from. Let me read a bit from it to you. He says, I pleaded, outlaw, wise by many a hearted casement, curtained red, trellised with intertwining charities. For though I knew his love who followed, yet I was sore already, adread, lest having him, I should have naught beside. He's saying I kind of knew that God was with me and that he wanted me and that he loved me, but I was terrified that if I loved him, then he'd be the only thing that I would have and everything else would abandon me. Now that's a real challenge, isn't it? It's all very well saying that God is already there, but if you're terrified that you can't get away from God and you're trying to run from him, where does that leave you? He is, as it were, the hand of heaven. But not just is he there, says the psalmist. Look again at verse 10. He's guiding. He's holding us. If I've used this illustration before, you must forgive me, but it bears repeating. Someone I know who's not from this church was traveling on business in Scandinavia. And in the course of his trip, he spent one night in a capital city. And as he was traveling, he was out in the evening, a thought occurred to him that he could, on that night only, because he was traveling from one place to another, in the middle of nowhere where he was not known, he could do absolutely anything he wanted. Anything that night. No one would know. If he wanted to go to spend all night in a seedy joint, he could do that. If he wanted to do all sorts of unimaginable things, he could do that. If he wanted to take drugs that night, he could do that. No one would know. His wife wouldn't know. His friends and colleagues wouldn't know. His church wouldn't know. His boss wouldn't know. He was, just for that night, anonymous. But then he stopped short. Because he thought to himself, actually, my wife may not know, my friends may not know, and my colleagues may not know, my family would know. But even though I'm in a place I don't know, God knows. And he's with me, and he's here right now, and he would know. You see, it's reasonable, therefore, to say that we could only get there, wherever there is, with his guidance and help anyway. Couldn't we? Even there, your hand will guide me. Well, I'm going to need God's help to get there. And again, what an awesome thought that he knows everything and that he is everywhere, guiding and providing and helping. But has that exhausted all the possibilities? What about, here's another scenario for you. What about if I were somehow overcome with evil, like my friend in Scandinavia? How about if somehow some dark forces could overwhelm me and swallow me and a nightmare scenario of darkness? What if the devil was absolutely set out to get me? What would I do then? What does David say? Verse 11. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, it'll capture me, it'll shut me off, it'll completely immerse me, the light will become night around me so I can't see one way from another, so that I can't see my hand in front of my face, so that it seems as though the whole world has ended. What will I do then? I remember reading some years ago a horrible sci-fi short story. Maybe I heard it on the radio. I didn't read it. And in this sci-fi short story, some terribly evil creature had taken the world, the village in which it lived, and taken it up so that there was nothing and nowhere, and it could do what it liked, and the people couldn't escape, and there was nothing outside, and they could have no communication, and there was nothing they could do. Imagine that for a minute. Here, says David, imagine it's just me on my own. The darkness has shut me away. I'm locked in some tomb somewhere, and it's night. Even the darkness, he says, verse 12, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, because darkness is as light to you. Read in the paper the other day that Wiltshire police are being given night vision goggles so that they can see things in the dark going on, poaching and that kind of thing. Well, bless them. God doesn't need night vision goggles. He knows everything, even about you and me. And he is everywhere, guiding and helping. And that is because, verses 3 to 18, he made everything, especially you and me. Let's follow it together. For you, says David, created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. Lord, you made me. You made my inmost being. You made me. You made my soul, you made my heart, my most personal private persona. The me that maybe everybody else doesn't know. The me that jumps up and runs to the front only when there isn't a queue, actually. You made the me that stares each night in the mirror and wonders to itself, what's the point? You made the me that lies in bed when the alarm goes off in the morning and thinks, can I really face another day? You made the me, Lord, that nobody else gets to see. You made the me that feels the grief of overwhelming odds and sees the race that I can never keep up with. You made the me that looks at the magazines and says to itself, I can't do that. You made the me, Lord, that nobody else gets to see. Have you ever wondered why it is that everyone else seems to have it so easy when you feel like your heart is breaking? The answer is because you feel your own frailty and uncertainness. And you only see the conclusions that they've drawn. But God sees it too. You made the me on the inside. But you made the rest as well. Says David, when I was forming in the womb, you made me. Molecular biology may have become more advanced. But you know, the creation of life still is just a pipe dream. And the creation of a human being, an impossibility. God made me. When I consider that, says the psalmist, I praise you in fear and wonder. Fearfully and wonderfully made. That there is someone, God, who can do that. And put it all together so well. Your works, says David, are wonderful. Hey, and I'm one of those. How about that? Have you ever looked at it that way before? Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. But he's just said, you made me. So that makes me wonderful. Now, you may not feel very wonderful, particularly if you're tired or grumpy or whatever it is. But that's not the point. From God's point of view, I am a demonstration of what he is like. Your works are wonderful and I'm one of those. Thank you, Lord, for making me. And thank you that I am not a mystery to you, verse 15 and 16. He says, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together, as it were, in the cave, in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. Before my mother even knew she was pregnant, you saw me. You knew. Now, he's not suggesting some kind of stork bringing a baby. This is poetry. He's painting a picture that God knows what's there before anybody else does. Throughout the Old Testament of the Bible, there's a mindset that presents the formation of the idea of a person as something secret. Let me quote to you from Job chapter 10. Job says, your hands shaped me and made me. Remember that you molded me like clay. Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? Clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinew. You gave me life and showed me kindness, and in your providence watched over my spirit. Have you ever seen a potter making a clay? I'm sure you have. Where they just get this lump of stuff. I mean, what is it really? It's mud. It's complicated. It's sticky mud is clay, really. And they get it, and they get a lump, and they throw it down, and then they form it into something beautiful. That's what God's done with you and me. The Lord saw us, unformed, and knew all of us. With our modern Western mindset, we may balk at the expression in verse 16. But actually it suffices to answer all the most fundamental questions of how am I here? And it continues with what I think is one of the most precious verses in the Bible. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. You see, the Lord knows everything. He is everywhere and he made everything, even us, even our days. Just stop and get your head around that statement. All our days are fashioned by him. that, you see, the psalmist has recognized what we simply cannot understand, that this is an implication of God being God. If God is everywhere and he knows everything and he made everything, then it must certainly be true that he knows what he's doing. He's got a book, says David, as it were. And it's not just a book of life demonstrating all our thoughts and all the embarrassing stuff. He's got this book called Your Name, and he's written in that book what's going to happen to you or to me every day. And he knows the day of our birth, and he knows the day of our death. And we are immortal until he has written today is the day we go to heaven. We are immortal. And he knows exactly what he's doing on each day. And when I get up in the morning and I look out of the world and there seems to be so much uncertainty, the answer is I can trust in the God who holds me tightly in his grip and has already written down my name on that day. That's brilliant, isn't it? When life is going right, it is a pleasure and a joy and a cause for thankfulness. But when life is going badly, it's a cause of pain. Yet, can I say there is great comfort in knowing that God is God and in charge. The key to life, it seems to me, is recognizing in life that God is sovereign. I don't mean with a stoical attitude of, well, okay, sirrah, sirrah, whatever will be, will be. And neither is it to remove personal human responsibility, which sits in the Bible, even though we can't get our heads around it. There's plenty of things we can't understand, but are true anyway. Take infinity for starters. But it is a grateful realization that there is nothing beyond him. And if you stop for a moment and think of the alternative, actually that fact is a much greater source of anxiety. If God has not fashioned all our days, then there is something greater than God, and that is called chance. And I think that's much more scary. Much more scary. It means that there's nobody in control from time to time in my experience. And that means that there are times when I am apparently outside of God's control, and that means there are places in my life or my experience or in my universe in which God is not God. No, 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 no. No, he is God, and it is true. And actually, his purposes for you and for me are vast. Look at verse 17. How precious to me or concerning me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sands. Literally, the Lord's purposes and thoughts for us are greater than all the sand that there is. Imagine going to a beach in the summer and picking up one of those handfuls of beautiful Cornish sand, for example, that we do down in St. Ives, and you let it run through your fingers, and you can see millions and millions and millions of grains of sand. And David makes this outrageous claim that God thinks about him more than all the grains of sand that there are in the world. David, that's a very arrogant thing for you to say, isn't it? You think God is all tied up with you? Well, just think. You see, the placement of every electron around every nucleus and every atom, the placement of every atom in every molecule, the placement of every molecule in every part of my skin and my blood and my hair, God's put them there on purpose. Is it impossible for God's thoughts about me to outnumber the grains of sand? No, no. Nor about you. And all of this news about God knowing everything is reflected in the New Testament. Hebrews chapter 4. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before the eyes of him to whom we must give account. No wonder then that David concludes with a section that he labels, as it were, God haters. Just look at those last few verses of the psalm. You see, if the Lord knows everything and is everywhere and made everything, even you and me, Even those who war against him are going to be found out and punished. And David actually, well, David doesn't want anything to do with them. Verse 19, if only you would slay the wicked, O God, he says, away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. There is a problem with this little section, isn't there? And while you can maybe understand his sentiments of loyalty for so faithful a king and reviling rebels and hating them, there is a part of us which surely says, hang on, I thought we as Christians were supposed to love everybody. And we shrug our shoulders and say something inappropriate like, well, that's just must be the difference between the Old and the New Testament. But that's not true. This is one Bible. There's a clear message for us to understand, and it's twofold. The first point is that David, the psalmist, hated only those who hated good. The great Spurgeon said, Jesus taught us to love all men with benevolence as our duty, but to love any wicked man with complacency as a crime. In other words, there's no place for stupidity. The enemies of God are not to be loved with impunity. The tendency to be undiscerning and to let anything go is not Christian. Jesus called sin, sin, and pointed to it clearly. On one occasion, even violently, to those who downgraded God. Only by being clear can we ever hope for people to recognize their own rebellion as clearly. David says, I'm God's man. I long to be God's man. I want to be God's man. And my attitude to wickedness is, please, no. And yet there is a second point here that is not to be lost. Because you see, if God knows everything, and God knows my heart, and he's seen that book that I described at the beginning that would cause all of us so very much horrendous embarrassment, then how can David ever claim anything like that? David was wicked beyond conception sometimes in what he did. We're studying 2 Samuel in the mornings. We haven't got yet to his adultery with Bathsheba, nor his murder of Uriah, let alone what he did with his son. Where are we left? Let me quote to you from Hebrews chapter 4. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. But we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. A high priest, remember, represents the people before God. David is a rebel, and so are you and I. The God who knows so much about us, who made us, who is everywhere, he knows very well what we're like. He's with David in his reaction to stay away from perhaps the temptation of wickedness. But he knows that David comes under the same category, and so do you and I. We're all God's enemies, actually, under this. And there's no doubt about it that God knows that completely. Which suddenly makes all the comfort of the psalm a jeopardy, doesn't it? It's scary. God knows me that well and is everywhere. I can't escape from him. I can't hide myself from him. I can't run away from him. What am I going to do with a God that knows that and leaves me like that? Answer? He hasn't left me like that. What chance? Well, this psalm is true for Jesus as well. And he hasn't sinned. And he isn't wicked. And he loved his enemies to death. He's lived here. And when God searched him, he found only holiness and purity. And as we read at the beginning this evening from Romans chapter 5, Jesus offered himself in our place. He died so we could endure all this searching. And when God finds in us rebellion, we can be forgiven. If only you would slay the wicked, O God. Is that what you mean when you look in the mirror? It's a terrifying thing to say, isn't it? That's exactly what he did, but not the wicked, his only son in our place. For a good man, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So the psalm concludes with David's plea. He's already said that the Lord searches him and knows him. But now he asks it again. And what's the plea? Listen. Listen, he says, search me, O God. Do it again and again and again. And know my heart. You know me. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me. And sort it out, Lord, please. Lead me in the way everlasting. You see, David was happy to be searched, found out, and forgiven. In the full knowledge that the Lord who knows everything and is everywhere and made everything, even him and even you and me, will forgive him and his faith in him and lead him onwards to heaven. And the clear and final message of Psalm 139 is therefore, how about you and me? Just remember tomorrow and tonight, God is with you and me. Wherever we are, whatever we're doing, he's searching us constantly, constantly, constantly searching us. He knows everything there is about us. He knows us far better than we know ourselves. And as he does that, will he find any wickedness? Well, of course, the answer is definitely. What's he going to do with it? And if you haven't already, will you turn and ask him to forgive you in Jesus' name? And if you have, then you have nothing to fear. But you have got this knowledge. He's there. And my measurement of myself must be that I belong to him.